Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. This is the Gala Final Primary Edition for 2010. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm the Gala Ken Rudin.
Yes, and Ken, yes. You know, I'm so glad you could be with us for Primary Season 2010. Let's wrap it up, shall we, Ken? What's still out there?
Well, on September 14th, Tuesday the 14th, we have seven states holding primaries, and the big question is,
will Kirsten Gillibrand break 65% in the Democratic primary for Senate in the state of New York?
You know, we haven't mentioned Kirsten Gillibrand's name in a long time, with good reason. Once upon a time, she was supposed to be endangered from the left, and then perhaps by Harold Ford in the primary, and yet there's absolutely no Republican.
I remember Harold.
Psst, call me.
Harold, call me.
But Kirsten Gillibrand is not somebody we talk about anymore because once upon a time she was a vulnerable appointee and now she's a
supposedly
safe
one
appointee.
Of the most vulnerable Democrats on the ballot in 2010. Boy, did that competition get a lot stiffer.
But there are some Democratic senators on the ballot on Tuesday who are vulnerable, perhaps not on Tuesday. For example,
Russ Feingold in Wisconsin,
whose name was not on any list of vulnerable candidates in 2010, and suddenly he's running basically dead even with Ron Johnson, this multimillionaire candidate backed by the Tea Party. But the primaries to watch, the fascinating result in Alaska on August 24th.
Joe Miller breakthrough.
Right, defeating Lisa Murkowski. And will that Tea Party momentum carry all the way to the very right-wing state of Delaware?
Obviously, Delaware is not a right-wing state. It's a blue state. It's Joe Biden's home state. This is Joe Biden's home seat. It's been held during this Congress by a placeholder, Ted Kaufman, who used to work for Joe Biden. And it was supposedly being held for his son,
Beau Biden,
but then Beau Biden didn't run.
Now, wait a second. Is Beau Biden Ted Kaufman's son, or is he Joe Biden's son? I'm confused here.
Very confusing. Very confusing. The names alone would lead you astray. So now what's happening is Mike Castle, longtime member of Congress, before that governor of Delaware.
The longest-serving member of Congress in Delaware history.
Wow.
Yep.
You mean House member.
House member, yep.
House member.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's trying to move on to the Senate to replace Joe Biden, who's, of course, been serving there since 1972 before becoming vice president. And Mike Castle would appear to be kind of a lockdown, obvious choice here. It's a Republican year. He is a Republican, but it's Delaware, kind of a blue state, but he's kind of a blue state kind of Republican.
Well, exactly.
He should be perfect, but what, Ken?
You know what? He may be a Republican in name only, according to Christine O'Donnell, the Tea Party candidate for the Senate in Delaware. And while we roll our eyes, or we have rolled our eyes in the past at the thought of a Christine O'Donnell serious candidacy, we probably rolled our eyes about Joe Miller a couple of weeks ago as well.
You know, Christine O'Donnell ran against Joe Biden in 2008.
Got clobbered.
And she got 35% of the vote. All right. That's obviously no threat to Joe Biden. But there were people in the state who were prepared to vote for her against Joe Biden.
Oh, yeah.
And they were Republicans, by and large. And they're going to come out on primary day this September. And it's not inconceivable that being a South is a rather small voting universe. And there is a lot of Tea Party sentiment in Delaware, as there is in many other blue states. It's not inconceivable that she could make a respectable showing, at least against Mike Castle. And she's running an extremely aggressive campaign against him. And, as you said, the Tea Party is putting in $250,000 for ads on the last weekend. She could make a showing here, and we just don't want to get Joe Millard again.
Right. But I guess part of the difference is that, of course, Lisa Murkowski was appointed by a guy who turned
back to Alaska now.
Right. Lisa Murkowski in Alaska was appointed by a guy who turned out to be very unpopular, her father.
Frank.
Frank Murkowski. And perhaps that was part of the problem she had, although she had other problems. But look, clearly, if we're talking about rhinos, I mean, Lisa Murkowski was not a liberal Republican. Mike Castle is a liberal Republican, but he's almost a god in Delaware. He's been running, as you say, member of Congress, former governor, lieutenant governor. He always wins big, even in Democratic years. So,
yes.
So the Republican Party, realizing what happened in Alaska, determined that it will not happen again in Delaware. They've gone all out with an assault on O'Donnell.
Carpet bombing her.
They really have. They learned the lesson of Murkowski. You know, Murkowski sat back, didn't respond, even though she had tons of money. They're not letting the same thing happen in Delaware with Mike Castle.
And in this particular case, as really was true with Murkowski, once past the primary, there's really no point in sitting on all that money because you're probably going to be home free in November in either state in this particular year.
Right. The difference, of course, is that ultimately for Republican purposes, it didn't matter who won in Alaska, just like it didn't matter who won in Utah with Bob Bennett being challenged by Tea Party folks like Mike Lee. But in Delaware, it does matter because it's hard to imagine in the unlikelihood, and I still think it's unlikelihood, that if Christine O'Donnell wins the Republican primary, there's no way she wins the general election in November against Chris Coons, owns the new...
Respectable Democrat.
Right, right. He's a Newcastle County executive, right. But one thing that is interesting to watch on Tuesday is what's going on with the Republicans in New Hampshire, the Senate seat Judd Gregg is giving up, and the Sarah Palin candidate, well, that's kind of unfair, but she is the establishment candidate, certainly, is Kelly Ayotte, the former state attorney general, who's really running a very nasty race with a kind of a moderate liberal, a businessman, Bill Binney, really ugly, and you wonder if that battle between Ayotte and Binney could help Ovid LaMontagne, the conservative, to win that nomination. But this is something, again, that threatens the, you know, we always talk about all these seats that the Republicans
should
pick up.
Fairly automatic in this year.
Every Republican, perhaps except LaMontagne, seems to be beating Paul Hoad, the congressman, the Democratic congressman, in trial heats.
But used to be popular a couple of years ago,
when the Democratic Party was popular. So I'm just wondering if, for all our focus on what the Tea Party might do in Delaware, it's interesting what the conservatives might do in New Hampshire if the establishment's plans of a Kelly Ayotte ascendancy doesn't come to pass.
All right. Quick point to make here about New Hampshire. What, besides the fact that she is a woman, is appealing to Sarah Palin about Kelly Ayotte?
Well, I think what's appealing to Sarah Palin is that New Hampshire is probably is somewhat known as the early primary for 2012. And I think if Kelly Ayotte is the Republican establishment choice for a senator, just as Terry Branstad is the Republican choice for governor in Iowa.
Right. She came in there despite the fact that he was not a Tea Party favorite. And normally speaking, you would not have seen her in the Terry Branstad camp. He's as establishment as a candidate could possibly be in that state, multi-term governor. And yet, Sarah Palin is right there for him. Here again, she wanted to be on the side that was winning.
And that's what's so interesting. I mean, she'll back a Terry Branstad in Iowa. She'll back a Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. And yet, also on Tuesday, she's backing Brian Murphy in Maryland against Bob Ehrlich, the former governor, the former Republican governor, who's a likely nominee.
Very likely nominee.
Who is Brian Murphy? Why pick him? I mean, he's a conservative, you know, whatever he
is. Well, he fits her profile better. But you would think that she would follow the same dynamic that she was following in Iowa and New Hampshire, except Maryland doesn't have an important Republican primary that comes right at the beginning of the process.
So maybe eventually, at some point, we stop talking about who Sarah Palin is backing in these midterm elections and start worrying about the actual races themselves. And so you have a bunch of interesting stuff coming up on Tuesday. The New Hampshire one, obviously, the Russ Feingold one, and you also have some congressional primaries as well.
Now, again, Feingold has no primary,
right.
and his opponent, Ron Johnson, has some other people on the ballot
but
they're nominal. So we know that Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold is the matchup for Wisconsin. One other race in Wisconsin, though, that is worth talking about is Milwaukee County Executive Scott Walker against former Congressman and former Senate candidate Mark Newman for the governorship. They've had a couple of terms of a Democratic governor there in Jim Doyle, not running for a third term, although he could have.
But this
is not a good year in Wisconsin for Democrats. That's why Russ Feingold's in trouble. It's why a couple of the House members are in trouble. It's why David Obie's seat might go Republican.
Possibly.
It's at least a possibility, right. And he retired. So a year in which you would expect the Republican nomination for governor to be particularly valuable.
Yeah, Newman has a lot of money, and he's self-financing his campaign, even though the party seems to be rallying behind Scott Walker. And I suspect that Scott Walker could very well be the next governor, assuming he wins the primary, which is not a slam dunk. But you still have a pretty strong candidate on the Democratic side. Tom Barrett, the former congressman, current mayor of Milwaukee, will be the Democratic nominee.
So then you would have a highly unusual circumstance of the governorship of Wisconsin coming down to being between the mayor of Milwaukee and the county executive of Milwaukee County. These two guys represent most of their constituents they hold in common. Usually the state doesn't look to Milwaukee for its governors, so that would be an unusual race in Wisconsin terms.
But a possible plus for the Republican Party, because if the Democratic candidate is not assured of a sweep, of a slam dunk in Milwaukee, which is a Democratic stronghold, Scott Walker could win statewide.
It makes it a little more difficult, though, for the Republicans to run strictly against Milwaukee, which they love to do. We started out talking a little about New York, but the really interesting race in New York is a House race on the Democratic side. Charlie Rangel, who has been in this seat since 1970.
Right, when he beat Adam Clayton Powell in the Democratic primary.
Is now trying to defend it against
Adam Clayton Powell IV, who is the son of the fellow that Charlie Rangel beat back in 1970. He ran against Rangel once before in 1994, got clobbered. But Charlie Rangel is in a different position, certainly a different position in 2010 than he was in 94. There are 13 ethics counts against him. There's going to be a public or some kind of a trial, an ethics trial coming out in September. And Rangel, who's 80 years old, is really fighting for his life. And some polls show that many of his constituents would love to see him gone. But there, the problem for the opponents is that there are several of them.
That's right.
And
while it's like Dan Burton in Indianapolis area,
who is very unpopular, but managed to win with like 21%
because 21% of the vote, and he won renomination.
So anyway, Charlie Rangel's the New York Times, for example, endorsed Joyce Johnson, who's not Adam Clayton Powell or Charlie Rangel.
And not a household name either.
Well, I think the feeling was that, you know, according to the Times, perhaps, and to a lot of people, Charlie Rangel may not deserve another term, but Adam Clayton Powell IV is a flawed candidate. And so Rangel could win by default, but it's obviously going to be the closest race he's had since he's come to Congress.
And, of course, in November he will be safe. And he will not necessarily be safe on Capitol Hill, where he is still subject to a proceeding in the House Ethics Committee that's being billed as a trial and could result in a reprimand or, I suppose, even conceivably stronger action on the part of the House. But at this point, I think the smart money is he wins his primary, he gets reelected in November, and whatever the House Ethics Committee meets out to him, he survives it and goes on. He will not be chairman of a committee again, but he goes on as a member of Congress.
Yes, although there had been some signals, perhaps from the Obama administration and the president himself, saying that it may not be the worst thing in the world to bow out with. You know, it's funny, Charlie Rangel was asked this week, he said, you should leave with grace. And then, of course, Charlie Rangel said, who's grace? I mean, he's still
Charlie Rangel.
Charlie Rangel.
Charlie Rangel.
But, you know, whether he wins or loses, you know, we're talking about a future. Somebody who apparently did lose, and we think she lost, is Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, and yet she's still talking about the potential of running as either as a Libertarian Party candidate, which is not likely to happen.
Just as she could be a write-in, too.
Or a write-in candidate. You know what she said, though? She said, I'm not a quitter. And if that wasn't a slap at Sarah Palin, I don't know what was. But she said, I'm not a quitter. I'm still in this race. And so there's speculation that she could run to keep her seat as a write-in candidate.
It would be a good question why you would give up the Libertarian line to her if you were the already nominated Libertarian candidate. Why would he do that?
Well, David Haas, who is going to get his 1% or 2%, and there's pressure on him by the Murkowski camp to step aside, but the Libertarian Party and Lisa Murkowski really don't have that much in common.
It would make more sense for him to step aside for Joe Miller.
Right, and give him 2 lines. I don't know if you can do that in Alaska.
It doesn't really matter. He would be more sympathetic. He would be more simpatico, really, with Joe Miller.
But also, I mean, she could also lose some kind of some leadership stuff in Washington if she decides to challenge Joe Miller, who, after all, is now the Republican-sanctioned candidate.
This would be a very interesting question for Mitch McConnell to resolve after the election. If she were to be elected as something other than a Republican, would he even let her keep that seat on the Appropriations Committee?
I suspect yes, but who is the only senator in history to be elected as a write-in candidate? Strom Thurmond.
I knew this. Sorry. One thing that's not likely to change in this last Tuesday of the primary process is the ratio between Republican voting and Democratic voting in this primary. And we have just seen a set of figures come out from the Center for the Study of the American Electorate at American University, run by Kurt Ganz, who's been doing this kind of study for many, many years. And it shows that for the first time since 1930, now, this would have been, what, like even before you started high school, Ken? 1930, more Republicans are voting in the primaries nationwide than Democrats.
4 million more. Now, of course, as you and I have talked in the past, yes, there are...
That's a small margin, but the Democrats used to dominate by tens of millions.
Oh, exactly. There are more Republican primaries going out there. Is there more intensity on the Republican
more
side?
More energy, more interest, yeah. More enthusiasm.
But, I mean, there was Republican enthusiasm in 94. There was Republican enthusiasm in 1980 and 1966. We're going back to 1930, the last time there have been more Republicans showing out for a primary season than the Democrats. And, again, we keep talking about who's going to show up in November. This is another sign that perhaps President Obama and the Democrats need to do something miraculous if they're going to hold on in November.
I don't think there's any question but that all the pressure is on the Democrats at this point. And this is just one more of those numbers that's not a poll. It's not a finger in the wind. It's just a hard number that says the people participating in the process this year are more likely to be Republicans. And that's going to obviously have its impact in December. One interesting sort of counter-trend story, it's not an election this fall, but one that obviously caught the attention of political junkies everywhere. Richie Daley saying, that's it, no more. I will have been mayor of Chicago for 21 years
plus.
And some months, And most importantly, that much longer than my dad. When does he pass? Is it about Christmas time?
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day. Yes. He passes Richard J. Daley's record. Richard J. Daley, of course, died in 1976 after 21 years as mayor. And once Richie's broken that record, he's willing to say no mas.
Right, exactly. We talked about mayor for life. Of course, his father died in office of a heart attack. He probably wanted to decide to go.
As did Harold Washington.
He did, exactly. Another Chicago mayor, first African-American mayor of Chicago. But Richie Daley probably wanted to go out on his own terms. Now that the shock seems to have subsided a bit, now there's just no shortage of candidates who are thinking of running. The Chicago Tribune had a headline this week that it's easier to name the people who are not running than those who are considering running. And, of course, you know who the top of the list is.
Well, the top of the list would have to be Ron Santo, the former third baseman for the Chicago Cubs. No, that's just fantasy. The top of the list, and for no other reason than because he can command such attention for what he may do, and because he has been the first chief of staff to the first president from Chicago in history, is Rahm Emanuel. He was a congressman from Chicago, who's already represented a large chunk of the city, some of the larger chunks in the city, and he is interested in the job and has been for quite some while.
And here's what he had to say last April on the Charlie Rose Show.
I hope Mayor Daley seeks re-election. I will work and support him if he seeks re-election. But if Mayor Daley doesn't, one day I would like to run for mayor of the city of Chicago. That's always been an aspiration of mine, even when I was in the House of Representatives.
Mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
But we always thought, a lot of people have been talking that if Mayor Richie Daley would ever leave the City Hall, then a serious African-American candidate or a Latino candidate would run. There's been no black candidate since, of course, the Harold Washington slash Eugene Sawyer
period,
era.
Which ended in 1989.
Correct.
So and Washington died in 87.
Right, and first elected in 83 after the great Jane Byrne era. But anyway, so there was always talk about a minority mayor in Chicago, and yet the people we're talking about are Rahm Emanuel, the Cook County Sheriff, who's also a white candidate, Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman, and his wife have both indicated that they are considering running, although I think Jackson has
been, a team?
Well, one or the other, and although I think it's sort of, I think Jackson has been tainted from the Blagojevich.
Hey, vote for one, get two.
But assuming Emanuel does leave the administration, obviously there's going to be some turnover in this administration come November 2nd, following what looks like right now. I mean, it's getting 7.5 weeks to go before the election. I mean, anything can happen, but right now it doesn't look good for the Democrats.
No, it's going to be either a difficult election or a disastrous election. And the fact is, the way they embraced this Rahm Emanuel for mayor trope at the White House this week, it almost looked like they were eager to have a reason to pull out the fulcrum piece, the chief of staff, and say, well, Rahm's going, and you know what? We're just going to have a big house cleaning. We're just going to basically turn it over and let a lot of new faces come aboard. And who's your candidate for new chief of staff?
Well, you know, obviously Tom Donilon, who's, I guess, on the Foreign National Security Council, I guess, and a longtime Democratic insider. Ron Klain, who's Vice President Biden's chief of staff, has been mentioned. I saw Valerie Jarrett's name mentioned. Tom Daschle has even been mentioned.
I've seen Leon Panetta's name
mentioned. Leon Panetta, sure. But the thing is, these are names. I mean, if you want to shake up this administration, and it seems like they do need some kind of shaking up if there is a big Republican win on November 2nd.
Or even if there isn't a complete Republican takeover of Congress, it's just time. The campaign staff, minus Rahm, was largely what took over.
Right.
The people who had
the
been
Axelrod,
around him,
right.
the Robert Gibbses, right. All the people who had been with him since the campaign, and they essentially became the White House staff, with some exceptions, and Rahm Emanuel was one, although Rahm had probably had at least some sort of advisory role in the Obama campaign as well. So we are past that. The great peak that they reached in 2007, 2008, very beginning of 2009, clearly has passed. They're into a totally different environment. Now they're going to have to battle a much stronger Republican presence on Capitol Hill. They need a new group.
They do. But one thing, we're talking about tactics a lot, and we're talking about how President Obama is trying to rally the disheartened troops, although I don't know if his speech this week in Cleveland helped or hurt, because it was a confusing economic message and what he's trying to do. And I thought it was interesting that and we mentioned this on NPR plenty of times, how he would talk about John Boehner over and over and over again, apparently eight times in the last speech.
Eight times in one speech, by name.
Now, I mean, we heard of Newt Gingrich, and of course we know Martin, Barton, and Fish, but do you think the American people, or at least the Democratic Party, are going to rally against a speaker, John Boehner?
Okay, Martin, Barton, and Fish,
right?
Three Republican congressmen. These were three guys FDR picked out to thrash back during the 1930s right. because he thought they symbolized Republican obstructionism.
Correct. And in case people don't know this, FDR is a highway in New York City.
That's why Martin, Barton, and Fish would be a household name for you, Ken, but yes. not necessarily for the listener. But I don't think John Boehner is a household name either. And you know what? Neither was Newt Gingrich in the fall of 1994. By winter, he'd been on every magazine cover. He'd been on every television show. But in the fall, you could not necessarily, as Bill Clinton of 1994, run against Newt Gingrich. Could you run around the country going, it's very scary, kids. Be very afraid.
But he ran against him
Here
in 96.
Comes Newt Gingrich. Well, of course.
Yes.
By then, we all knew who the guy was. But it's hard to run prospectively against a bête noir who is not noir yet, because most people don't even know he's a bête.
Ron, you already mentioned that Tuesday is the last day of the Tuesday primaries, but there is one more primary on the 18th in Hawaii. Governor Linda Lingle is term limited. She's a Republican. Among the Democrats seeking their party's nomination to succeed her is Neil Abercrombie. And you know, of course, the famous FDR attack on Abercrombie and Fitch.
And Martin and Barton and Fish. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
South Sea Island magic is made of the light from the stars, breezes from the mountains.